My name's Paul Rosenzweig. I'm a flying officer in the Australian Air Force Cadets. And for the last couple of years, I've been the public affairs officer for Six Wing, which is responsible for South Australia and Mildura. I started in the role in 2016. And one of the things that struck me was that these young people have some amazing stories to tell. They've enjoyed some great opportunities through the Air Force Cadets. And I just thought that listeners would really appreciate hearing some of those stories from young people that have had maybe some challenges in their lives, and the Australian Air Force Cadets has helped them overcome those challenges, develop as a person, and start on the pathway to adulthood and a career. So in the beginning of 2017, we lined up our first interviews, and over the course of 2017, 2018, we've actually done a total of 24 interviews now. Mostly cadets and a few staff as well. A lot of cadets with good stories to tell. It's been great. We started with the first one. We had a couple of young ladies come in and talk to us about the ceremonial activities that they've been in, the various different community commemorative events that they've participated in with the Air Force Cadets. And one of the things that really stands out from doing those activities is just how much self-discipline and teamwork they learn, as well as giving themselves a sense of pride and belonging in their community. So that was really interesting to hear their story about how that involvement in those activities was generating that sense of discipline and teamwork. And just out of interest, one of the girls, very, very passionate interview she gave, she's just completed the requirements for her Gold Duke of Edinburgh Award, and she's received her badge, and she'll be attending at Government House very shortly to receive her certificate from His Excellency the Governor. So that's another sense of achievement. After that, we spoke to another couple of cadets who had progressed through their training and were at the end of their training, so to speak, and were taking appointments within their squadron. One was the Cadet Executive Officer and one was the Cadet Squadron Warrant Officer for their squadron. And they talked about the leadership opportunities that are available through the AAFC and also the aviation opportunities that they'd taken up. One of those had taken a scholarship, gone to solo status in the AAFC. You might be interested to know that he's now a trainee pilot with one of Australia's regional airlines. So another really significant progression from cadet into adulthood and career. We went on and spoke to another couple of cadets about their aviation opportunities that they'd participated in. One of those had just received the Bronze Award in the Duke of Edinburgh International Award, and she was learning to fly under a flying scholarship, so she talked about her ambitions there. Just out of interest, this year, she's completed her senior non-commissioned officer's course. She's just been promoted to Cadet Sergeant. She's close to finishing her Gold Duke of Edinburgh Award badge, and she's also just about qualified as a solo pilot in the gliders. That's another amazing story. I started off by saying that these cadets all have interesting stories to tell about their service and the opportunities, but I've been fortunate to be in a position to see them progress over the last couple of years and now be able to relate where they've gone. And that's really heartening. The second cadet in that interview had actually just gone solo in a DG-1000 glider at Balaclava Airfield just a week or so before, and it was just after his 16th birthday. That qualified him for the AAFC first solo badge in gliding. But early in that year, he'd actually completed his first solo flight in a powered aircraft, which made him eligible to receive the first solo badge powered. But you can only wear one badge. So he'd put his paperwork in for the first one, went solo in the glider, put his paperwork in for that one, and while he was on air with Service Voices talking about these opportunities, we had Six Wing's chief flying instructor for gliding present with us, and at the end of that interview, he was able to present Thomas with his AAFC solo pilot badge on air, which was a really big achievement and a bit of a surprise for him, and it really capped off his flying career, which at that stage was a great achievement, but he's gone on now and qualified, now wears the actual pilot wings. So he's a fully qualified AAFC pilot now. One of the interviews, we had a 14-year-old cadet, only been in for a little while, and she talked about her reasons for joining the AAFC and where she saw her future. She's progressed, just graduated from the junior NCO course beginning of this year. She's now a cadet corporal, taking on a leadership responsibility in her squadron. We've had a brother and sister pair of twins from the Adelaide Hills. They talked about their squadron pride, what their colour patch stands for, and why they were fiercely proud about it. We had another cadet from RAF Edinburgh tell us about the activities which challenge and are in some ways competitive. But by comparison, the Duke of Edinburgh Award Scheme only ever has people competing with themselves. It's not a competitive scheme as such. It's a program that's set up to allow young people to challenge themselves to achieve. So Anna spoke to us about how the AAFC challenges her and some of the competitive elements within it, but at the same time, how she challenges herself to do better and how her cadet service was a perfect fit with the Duke of Edinburgh's award. And she's now a Gold Award participant, coming close to achieving her Gold Award. Towards the end of last year, we had two cadets reflecting on the commemorations that related to the centenary of World War I. Our Australian Air Force cadets have a strong tradition of supporting these community ceremonial events, from Anzac Day, Remembrance Day, through to some of the others, the Malaya Borneo Veterans Day. Last year, there was a special ceremony for the anniversary of the start of the Malayan Emergency. And our cadets not only participate in these activities, but they take a special pride in understanding what they're about and why it's important to commemorate and to mix with the veterans and hear their stories. They understand the importance of honouring the fallen, but they also enjoy the time that they can spend with our veterans and hear of their experiences. And that cadet service helps to bridge the generations, I think. One of my favourite interviews was when we had two cadets talking to Fiona about their service to the community, but specifically focusing on their career aspirations. Both of the lads were looking to a career in the Defence Force, one in the Air Force, one in the Navy. And one of the many benefits that service in the Air Force cadets brings is that opportunity for cadets to get a feel of what military lifestyle is like as a bit of a sample before they consider entry into the ADF. This was actually the second set of interviews that we'd done. At the beginning of 2017, when I'd come in for that very first interview, I'd scoped out the layout of Cinema Place, and I knew that there was a seat that I could take inside the cinema lobby, which not only kept me cool while I was waiting, but it gave me a clear view of Cinema Place, and I could see the cadets when they arrived. So on this particular day, I saw this elderly couple coming towards the door of the cinema, and I recognised them as people that I knew. And so I jumped up, went over to the door, and Doug had a walking frame, and I opened up the door, and actors and usher all very formal and welcomed them to the cinema, and they saw that it was me, and they were very happy to see me, and we had a bit of a chat, and then they came in. I saw the cadets moving up, so I wandered across, and of course the cadets didn't know that I knew these people, and one of the cadets said, "Oh, sir, we saw what you did, sir, that was very gallant." And I explained to them that it was an old army recon habit of mine to be waiting and watching. And on that previous visit, I'd found the perfect place to set up my observation post because there's an old army saying that time spent in reconnaissance is never wasted. The cadets did a great interview, especially about how their cadet experiences helped prepare them for a career in defence. Fiona wrapped up this part by saying something like, "Eric, where are you going now with your life?" So Eric talked about how he's always had a desire to serve Australia, and he was looking at a career in the Navy, and that his time in cadets had given him a glimpse of what a defence service might be like. And he said, "Cadets helped me consider that joining defence was an option for me." And then, perfectly straight-faced, he stole my line. In the Army, they have a saying, "Time spent in reconnaissance is never wasted." And it was just like he was a stand-up comedian that had delivered the punchline to end his routine, and he'd just thrown the microphone down on the stage. Boom.
That's what military training does for you. It tells
Honestly,
you to be prepared and to be flexible.
These cadets are just simply amazing.
Paul, lovely stories. We've heard what the cadets have got out of the Australian Air Force Cadets Scheme. What have you got out of it yourself?
I've come from a background where I started as an Army reservist myself many years ago. Later, when I was in Mackay, I had the opportunity to work with Army cadets, and I was a school teacher, and I've had an involvement with the Duke of Edinburgh Awards previously. And so coming out of defence full-time and having the opportunity to come back into a situation where I'm working with young people, it's just rewarding to see them develop. So you take someone who's struggling a little bit with some of the things in their life, they're not quite sure where they're going, what they're doing, They pick up some of the skills that the Air Force cadets has to offer. They take up the opportunities that are offered. And you just see them grow. You see them develop. And you see the changes in them as people, as they're growing physically and maturing as young adults coming into their later teens. But emotionally, you see them maturing as well. And just the ability to have a mature conversation with a young person is really rewarding. I have an interaction with quite a few across the board through this public affairs role. And we've done a lot of activities over the last few years. We've had a lot of cadets tell their story that I've been able to share, not just here on the radio, but through print medium as well. And, you know, that pride in what they do reflects on us as an organisation, on their leaders, on themselves and their peers.
Well, apart from your public affairs and communication officer role with the AAFC, Paul, you're also the public affairs officer and historian for the SANT branch of the National Malaya Borneo Veterans Association. You mentioned you'd been in the Army, but you weren't just a reservist, you actually served in the Army, didn't you?
Yes, I did 20 years as an Army reservist, which included a lot of time with the Northwest Mobile Force up in Darwin. And even though nominally it was a reserve regiment, it had a very large regular Army cadre, and a lot of the activities that we did were real-time operations across the north of Australia. So that was a role that had a very real-time component to it in terms of the security of Australia. And this is before things like Border Command and Northern Command, before any of this existed, and we were operating up there semi-independently with a direct chain of command through to Army headquarters, effectively. It was a busy time, it was very rewarding, and from that I continued on with a career in the regular Army for 12 years. That included 3 years in the Philippines as an assistant defence attaché, and then in 2010 I had the chance to go back to East Timor for 12 months. In the early days I did a couple of short trips over, but in 2010, having the chance to go back to see the changes, to see the development, to work with the Timorese Armed Forces, that was rewarding, to see the cycle turn, if you like, to go full circle, back to some stability, getting the country back on track, nation building, so to speak. I really enjoyed that.
And was this what encouraged you to have such an interest in history and the preservation of history?
I'm tempted to say I've always had an interest in history, but if I go back to year 12, if I could find my history teacher from year 12, I really want to thank him for getting me through, because I was going to bomb that out. I had not so much no interest, but it just wasn't relevant. I just seemed to be learning a lot of sort of Southeast Australian history that didn't seem relevant to me in any way here in South Australia. And I was pretty light-hearted about my approach to my assignments and essays, and I think I'm just lucky that I had a teacher who was tolerant, let's say. But as the years went on after that, I started to take a bit more interest in the military history as a reservist, learning some of our military history. Then I started getting involved in doing a bit of research, spending time with veterans, documenting some stories, and it kind of escalated from there to the point where I was actually compiling information for a regimental history. I was compiling other information that ended up being published. And through a little bit of good luck and fortune, I managed to get a couple of books published through historical societies and so on, and a few papers published. And that led me to just continue probing and looking and identifying the aspects of Australian military history that had either been overlooked or forgotten.
And one of those areas that have been overlooked or forgotten was the participation of our Filipino Australians in Australia's military forces. Talk about that.
Yes, we had a period where I was in Darwin, and it was the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Darwin, and I was at Government House putting some information and briefing packages together, and I had the opportunity to actually go back and revisit the casualty lists. And I found quite a number of anomalies, and basically, to keep that part of the story short, revisited the casualty lists, rewrote them, allowed for the double counting and names that were misspelt and a bunch of simple errors, rewrote the casualty list as the most comprehensive and accurate list that could possibly be put together given the circumstances. Fast forwarding to 2013, the Philippine Honorary Consul up in Darwin was preparing to do a commemorative service to honour some Filipino merchant mariners who'd been killed in the bombing of Darwin. And we knew about this, but they'd never really been counted as Filipino casualties. They were listed as merchant sailors on these two particular ships that had been bombed. And in fact, those two ships weren't bombed in Darwin Harbour. They were never actually in Darwin. They were bypassing Northern Australia on their way to the Philippines, running weapons and ammunition and food and supplies into Mindanao to make their way up to Corregidor for MacArthur's garrison. And there were, I believe, eight ships all up, making different routes and different times, trying to get through the Japanese blockade. Two of them happened to be coming across the north of Australia as the Japanese aircraft were doing their reconnaissances on the 18th of February 1942, and they had bombs dropped on them, they were shot at, ships weren't damaged, nobody was injured, but the Japanese certainly knew they were there. The following day, when that first Japanese raid occurred, the Japanese came through, bombed Darwin, and then the aircraft, as they were returning back to their bases or back to their carriers, dropped their remaining bombs and attacked these two ships. So a number of casualties as a result of that. One American soldier lost his life and the rest were Filipinos. Again, to cut that short story short, the Honorary Consul up in Darwin was putting together a commemorative ceremony to honour those Filipinos. So he contacted me knowing that I had the records, that I'd researched this, and I was able to give him the correct list of names. Put a plaque together, the Philippine ambassador and one of the territory ministers unveiled the plaque. They unveiled the plaque on the 18th of February because that was the day those ships were first attacked. Even though the casualties were sustained the next day, I thought it was important to acknowledge that these Filipino merchant sailors had come under attack before the bombing of Darwin. So the plaque was unveiled, but what that did was it opened up a whole bunch of pathways for me to research. In researching that, at the same time, we had to acknowledge that there were Filipino-Australian wharf labourers who were killed in the bombing. And there were five Filipino-Australians killed on the wharves in Darwin in that first raid. They were the descendants of Filipinos who'd come out in the late 19th century and settled first on Thursday Island, then they came across to Darwin, had families. Some worked on the shift, some had the day off, some were killed, some by good fortune missed out by doing shift changes. And those people needed to be recognised as well. As an incidental part of the research, I started researching those. What that led me to discover is that one of the Filipino Australians who was killed on the wharf had actually volunteered for the Australian Imperial Force in 1915. So that led me to think, well, how many Filipinos did we have serving in the AIF? That's something I'd never heard of. So I started researching that. His brother had been rostered off that morning, so he wasn't involved in the bombing of Darwin. He had also enlisted in 1915 and served overseas in France. I then looked a bit deeper. I actually came up with eight Filipino Australians who'd volunteered in 1915 to join the Australian Imperial Force. Six of them served overseas. Two were killed, one in France, one in Belgium, and one was awarded the military medal. Three were wounded in action. That's a pretty significant outcome for six people.
Sure is.
Three wounded in action, two killed, one gets the military medal, and they were all involved. Those that were wounded were involved in the significant battles. They were fighting as Australians in World War One. Went on, found out that they and other families had descendants who then served in World War II, up around 22 of them. Some, I think we had three serve in the Royal Australian Air Force. The others served in various capacities with the Australian Imperial Force. And from those families, we then had Filipino Australians who served in Malaya, Borneo, Vietnam, through to the modern day where we have Filipino-Australians still serving in the Australian Defence Force today. So that was a chain of research events that was just set in motion by a single phone call. It's just kept me busy for the last 6 years.
Incredible, and setting the record straight, and also bringing to light these marvellous stories. And it's important that we remember all of our veterans. We don't just think that they were born on a farm somewhere in rural Australia.
That's right. There are so many stories that are tied up with all of these people.
And talking about the stories, your role as historian for the South Australian Northern Territory branch of the Malaya Borneo Veterans Association. Talk about the research that you've done there.
I got involved with them a few years ago through the Australian Air Force Cadets. They were running a Malaya Borneo anniversary commemoration at West Torrens, and we had some Air Force cadets doing the catafalque party for them. And that led me to make contact, and then I realised that while their name says Malaya Borneo Veterans, they really encompass all veterans of the campaigns in that general area from Malaya, World War II, the Malayan Emergency, Confrontation, Malay Peninsula, Borneo. And they've encompassed East Timor as well as part of that geographic spread. So that sort of gave me the opportunity to say, well, I'll get involved with you and help plan some of these activities. So I've been involved with them for a few years now, and I've taken on the public affairs role. I run the Facebook page for them. And as we came up to the 70th anniversary of the start of the Malayan Emergency last year, it struck me that not many of those names are actually honoured anywhere. They're listed on the War Memorial in Canberra. Some individual names are parts of honour rolls around the country. But it's always been spoken of as a forgotten war. It was an emergency, not a war, because of protecting the insurance aspects for the traders and the businesses over there. And because of that and a number of other factors, it never really came to prominence all that much. It lasted for 12 years. Australia wasn't directly involved for all of that time, but we had a very significant commitment to the Malayan Emergency. That rolled on pretty much immediately afterwards into confrontation. The nature of confrontation, the secret deployments, the cross-border operations that stayed secret for so many years afterwards led confrontation to also be a bit of an undeclared secret war. And parts of that history are slipping away. What I found was that the South Australian Northern Territory branch was very active in trying to keep that memory alive. And they had established links in Sarawak. They had run reunion trips. They took a party across for the anniversary of the end of confrontation, and they unveiled a plaque that listed the casualties, the Australian casualties from confrontation. And we sent a small contingent of Air Force cadets with them to be the catafalque party for that commemorative event. Now, that may not seem all that significant to people. You know, unveiling a plaque happens all the time. But in the Heroes Cemetery in Kuching, there's a memorial wall. It's dedicated to the Malay heroes that lost their lives during those campaigns. And this was only the second foreign plaque to be unveiled. So this plaque that was unveiled by the Malaya Borneo Veterans Association was only the second foreign plaque approved to be put in that hero cemetery. And that's a pretty significant event. The second thing the branch does is they remember Malaysia. The ceremonies that they conduct and the overseas visits that they hold, like this one coming up in August later this year, reaffirm the strong values and deep friendship that we Australians share with our Malaysian counterparts and also the other allied countries that we have served beside, not just in Malaysia, but during all wars and peacekeeping operations. This anniversary that's coming up later this year, there's a large contingent from New Zealand coming across, so we'll, again, have the Australian and New Zealanders standing shoulder to shoulder commemorating the fallen. One of the things that the branch does is that they hold fundraising activities, sausage sizzles and various other things, and that allows them to make 3 donations to schools in Sarawak. The third thing the branch does is they honour the living. They continue to acknowledge the service of our surviving veterans, and where possible, we acknowledge those veterans of those Malayan campaigns during the ceremonies. Fourthly, they look to the future. Through these commemorative services, they establish bonds with our local cadets. And one of the things that I like to point out is that in the 50s and early 1960s, how many of those who deployed to Malaya had actually served in a cadet unit before they joined up for military service, not thinking that within a few years they'd be deploying on active service themselves. And if we bring that forward, some of the cadets that we've had here on Service Voices talking, their peers have now joined the Defence Force and they're now serving as members of the Australian Army, the Royal Australian Air Force, they're at ADFA. Within a year or two, they may well be veterans themselves on a new operational deployment or humanitarian mission.
It's a very big commitment that you've made both to the AAFC and to the National Malaya Borneo Veterans Association.
I've been in some pretty precarious situations overseas in my military service where any slight change in circumstances could have put me in the same position as some of these people that we're commemorating. And I like to think that if my name had ended up on a memorial or a roll of honour somewhere, that someone would actually take the time to remember me.
Paul, thank you very much for coming in today and talking with us about it.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.